Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Another hot topic of discussion on Franchise Today is the franchise legal landscape. We're going to be getting some perspective and insight from franchisee attorneys Michael Webster and Paul Steinberg today, as well as some highlights and a recap of the recent ABA forum on franchising. And I'm joined here at the start of the show with co-producer Joe Caruso. Joe, how are you today?
Fantastic, Paul. Glad to be here again.
Well, we had an awesome show last week with Tom Spadia, and a very riveting conversation. I look forward to having Tom on again in the future. And I also know we have some really exciting shows coming up as we lead into the Thanksgiving weekend. Now, why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of that?
Well, next week we have Shelly Sun, and Shelly Sun is the CEO of Brightstar. It's a home health franchise, and Shelly just got done writing a new book, Grow Smart and Risk Less. Also, interestingly enough, Shelly was on Undercover Boss. So that show is going to be very, very interesting because there's so much to talk about. We've got a franchising element with a very successful franchisor. We've got a brand new book, and we've got a reality TV show. So this guest is going to have a lot to say, and I'm not sure an hour is going to do justice to what we'll be talking about.
Well, certainly it's going to be a riveting show. I received Shelly's book the other day, and I am pouring through it, and hopefully you'll get through it over this weekend. Grow Smart, Risk Less, as she says, a low-capital path to multiplying your business through franchising. Really a good read right now, and probably a good read for most franchisors or individuals that are starting a franchise, and most franchisors that are in the startup phase. I really look forward to finishing it. Definitely look forward to speaking with her. And then, so that's next Thursday, the 10th of November at 11 a.m. Central Time. And then the following week, who do we have?
Well, we've got Mark Fidgman, and Mark Fidgman is an employment attorney. He's going to be talking about the HR challenges for franchisees and franchisors. And the title of his show is Why You Should Care About Tattoos, Facebook, and the End of the Alphabet. And Mark's got some really great insights on HR issues in the brave new world with social media, the internet, and all of the exciting things that we have in the commercial space these days, and how all of those innovations have impacts and implications on hiring and managing employees. So we've got an exciting show set up for Mark, and it'll be interesting to find out what tattoos, Facebook, and the end of the alphabet all have to do with each other and HR issues.
Well, give us just a little insight into the end of the alphabet, because I know some people out there might be sitting there saying, what are they talking about? Just a little insight on the end of the alphabet.
Well, we'll give you a peek. He's really talking about generational aspects of and demographics. He's talking about the X and the Y generation and how they differ from previous generations, from the baby boomers, the millennials, and all of the different aspects of how these people think, what they look for in jobs, and how they communicate. And the HR issues that arise from what their practices are and their characteristics.
Well, and certainly Generation X, Generation Y are the reference to the end of the alphabet. And be anxious to see what they're going to do after Generation Z is over. Anyway, should be a great event. And, franchise professionals will again be flocking to L.A. This weekend for the West Coast Franchise Expo. That's a popular event sponsored by our friends over at the International Franchise Association. It'll be held at the Los Angeles Convention Center tomorrow, November 4th, through Sunday, November 6th. And although the event is primarily for individuals interested in exploring franchise opportunities, the event also provides an opportunity for franchise professionals to network and of course, share information with other franchise pros. And as social media continues to be a popular topic of discussion, many will be exploring ways to effectively use and integrate social media in their franchise organizations. And, you know, for various reasons, consumer marketing, for franchise lead generation, et cetera. And, of course, that's where I feel I come in. During the expo, I'll be presenting three different times, Joe, within the seminars and the in-depth symposium all about franchise social media. Tomorrow, on Friday, I'll be there at 1 o'clock on a free seminar talking about integrating social media for franchise lead generation, what I feel is an effective approach. And then on Saturday, I will be joining, or I've been asked to join, Franchise Today, a former Franchise Today guest and a very strong friend of ours, Lee Plave, partner at Plave Cook. And his event is Web 2.0, Social Networking and Data in Franchising. And I'll be presenting about 45 minutes to an hour on that, social media basics and beyond. And then on Sunday, while everybody will probably be watching football, hopefully I won't be standing in a room by myself, I'll be presenting at 2:30 another free webinar, free seminar called Franchise Lead Generation and the Smooth Transition from Online to In-Person. And, of course, we're talking about franchise sales. So it should be an exciting weekend. Looking forward to seeing a lot of our franchise friends out there. And should be a good event. Well, talking about good events, today I think we have a good one right here on Franchise Today. As Joe, we're, you've lined up some great guests again. We have former or past guest, Michael Webster, franchisee attorney from Toronto, Canada. He's also a social media lawyer, chair of the Strategic Committee of the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Michael's been our guest in the past on both franchise legal series, both in 2010 and 2011. So I look forward to speaking with him today. And we're also joined by Paul Steinberg, who's also a franchisee attorney, but has an interesting twist in his background is that he's a former franchisee. So I'm real anxious to get this started, and I welcome them both to today's show. Michael, how are you today?
I'm pretty good, Paul. I wish I was going down to Los Angeles with you. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, I think it will be, and along with the fun, I think it'll be very informative. But you could always plan on visiting us at the Franchise Expo South in Miami in January. I'll be there as well, so we'll have to hook up in the warmer weather. That's for sure. I'm sure you'd be happy to get out of Canada for a few days in the heat of winter or the cold of winter. And then also we have Paul Steinberg on the air with us. Paul, welcome to Franchise Today.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, we certainly welcome you both. Michael, again, welcome you back. And Paul, we appreciate you being with us to provide your firsthand recap of last month's gathering of the who's who in franchise law at the 34th annual meeting of the ABA Forum on Franchising. In Baltimore, of course, Joe's backyard. As many of you know, as I said also, Michael Webster's a franchisee, attorney, social media lawyer, chair of the Strategic Committee of the IAFD. And Paul, before we get started, I wanted to share a little bit more about your background. You're New York City-based, and you represent primarily franchisees. And as I said, before becoming an attorney, you were a franchisee in the Subway franchise system. So what prompted you to make the leap from franchisee to franchise attorney.
Well, some people make the joke that if you're a franchisee, you have to become an attorney. But I'd always had an interest in the legal aspects of business. What particularly interests me about franchising is that it crosses so many disciplines. You've got contract, you've got real estate, you've got antitrust. And it's also an area where historically the law has been very imbalanced for various reasons. The law has been very, very imbalanced. And so as a franchisee side attorney, you've got to find new ways to skin the cat. And a lot of that is using negotiation skills. I mean, I know we're going to talk a little bit later about advertising funds, but I mean, that's one area where the law is very imbalanced. But as an attorney, you try and negotiate to achieve a better outcome.
Very interesting. And yeah, we definitely have some bullet points to discuss. But it's interesting, as you said, franchisees almost have to be an attorney. I definitely can feel with you there because I too was a franchisee, a multi-unit franchisee as that, and ironically or not, worked within a system and failed and succeeded, or I should emphasize succeeded and failed within the same system and within the system that I was previously the president and leader of the organization. So definitely had a very unique experience, and I believe we have that up on the IAFD blog site with respect to my supplier membership there, and there's an article in there about the fear and consequences of failure that I am more than happy to share with franchisees in every walk of life, because it really is a compelling story in a way that I really believe can help franchisees turn their business around if they're in such a position, and always make myself available to talk to franchisees that might be in that type of situation. Now, for those of us in the audience that are new to franchising and did not know for the past 34 years now, franchise lawyers on both the franchisor side and the franchisee side have been gathering every year to talk about franchise law. Michael, why do they do it? What do they talk about, and why should it be important to franchisors and franchisees?
Well, I mean, the ABA Forum in the last 7 or 8 years, and perhaps a little bit longer, has gone out of its way to try to establish a more collegial relationship between franchisee side and franchisor side attorneys, the idea being that if we can talk about issues, large issues, before they turn into particularized disputes, it's easier to, as Paul says, it helps grease the negotiation wheels if you're collegial with somebody and you've met them, you know, 3 or 4 times at the forum in an atmosphere in which the issues at a general level can be discussed. And, I think there's a lot of value to that, although Paul will tell you that there are some downsides to the emphasis on collegiality.
Paul, you were at the ABA Forum on franchising. What was the tone in the room with respect to, you know, the current economic environment and some of the issues coming down the pike with franchising?
Well, obviously that's something that people at the lunches and in the hallways were talking about quite a bit. There's a real problem. There's a pragmatic problem for franchisors because People are having a tough time getting bank loans. People can't cash in their 401ks are way down. They can't get home equity because their houses are underwater. So there's a pragmatic problem in terms of the sales process. But also one of the things that a lot of franchisors are struggling with now is the issue of updates, remodels, that type of thing. Certainly if you're in the retail franchise sector, such as the QSR, the restaurant sector, you need to freshen your brand image every few years. Well, right now, people are having a hard time if you're doing a remodel and you need $50,000, $100,000 or more to do a remodel. It's tough. So that is a concern. And I think the consensus seemed to be in a lot of these cases that in some cases the franchisors have gotten a lot more actively involved in seeking out lenders and working with preferred lenders. The idea being that if a lender is getting a significant chunk of business and if a lender is getting familiar with a particular franchise system, that it'll make it easier for the franchisees.
Hey, Joe, you've spent many years on the food service side of franchising, having worked at Hardee's, and, of course, Gloria Jean's and others. What's your perspective with respect to, you know, the contractual agreement that franchisees must remodel their restaurants and their you know, give that brand a refreshing, if you would, especially in today's economic times, and kind of give me the perspective from the franchisor's point of view.
Most franchisors want people to remodel sooner rather than later, and they'd love to have them reinvest in the location because the money's not coming out of the franchisor's pocket. But as a practical matter, a remodel doesn't necessarily mean that a franchisee's sales are going to increase because they have to put in $75,000 or $100,000 doing a refresh on their lobby. And you have to be thoughtful and careful about how you schedule remodels and what you want them to look like. And I think the franchisors that take great care in defining, you know, what the remodel should be about and how long it should last, do better than ones that that are kind of fashionable about it, and they have a new idea and they want to create a beautiful building because the leader of the company wants to have beautiful buildings out there. On the other side of the equation, you have franchisors that are loathe to enforce and get compliance out of the franchisees in reinvesting in their physical facilities to refresh the brand. And in that case, oftentimes you have a recalcitrant leader that doesn't want to go out there and push people to reinvest. That leader leaves, new regime comes in, and, of course, they see the deferred maintenance, they see the deferred refresh, they see a lot of tired old buildings, and all of a sudden they want to miraculously change the whole system to be current and up to date. So that's kind of what I see.
Sure is an interesting crossroads. Michael, do you have a perspective on this?
Yeah, I think that I think what Joe is saying and Paul is saying is right, is that if, and especially when you don't have, good system-wide metrics as to, so everybody can see two things. One is the amount of money that the system is going to need to do a remodel in the coming years, and what the evidence is going to be that there's an effect on your return on investment for that. And when you don't get those metrics on a system-wide basis in the hands of your operators, I think it's harder to convince them, especially in more difficult times, economic times, to, you know, put aside that money or plan for it.
Yeah, certainly unit economics plays a big part of this, and having the systems and procedures and processes in place definitely is the case. Paul, I understand that there were practical discussions on advertising fund best practices, control, accounting. Could you break down the finer points of what was discussed at the ABA forum on franchising and why it's important?
Well, I think the biggest thing, based on a few years of experience, including with the subway system, which has had some rather contentious fights over advertising, what struck me was the very practical orientation taken this year. And by that I mean the courts have traditionally given franchisors very, very wide discretion, particularly if they've properly drafted their agreements. And the Kentucky Fried Chicken case is a separate issue. I'll get to that in a second. But for the most part, franchisors can pretty much do they can ride roughshod over franchisees. Now, what the presenters were really focusing on was not so much whether you can do that, but whether that's a smart thing to do. And they did stress the issue on getting buy-in from the franchisees. And I've got to say, as being a former franchisee myself, that's very important. I mean, franchisees can tolerate missteps in an ad campaign that gets tired or whatever. If they think that the franchisor is genuinely trying to market the product, and where you get people to feel that their concerns are being respected, the presenters, I think, were right, and the consensus in the audience was, why pick a fight with your franchisees when the input actually will help, particularly with advertising, because they're the people on the ground. They're the people that see if a new ad runs, they're the people that see the very next day if traffic is increasing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you made reference to the KFC case, and from what I heard, the conversations, of course, at the ABA forum was, you know, focused on the association and the KFC's roles. What else? How far did the discussion go at the event? And what are some of your thoughts with respect to the KFC case?
Well, I mean, you know, KFC. You know, a lot of times people try and look at franchising as though it's monolithic, and of course it's not. Even within, say, the QSR segment, it's not. There is, you have systems such as McDonald's or KFC where you have a lot of multi-unit operators and a lot of money involved, I mean, big multi-unit operators. And then you have smaller systems, say, for example, a Subway, where you have a lot of people that may own you know, one or two stores. And it's a different type of a thing. I think one of the things that you need to remember with KFC, and the judge did kind of touch on this, was that there had been a long history at KFC. And there had always been a lot of back and forth, and the advertising people had considerable latitude. Now, that's not true in a lot of systems. I think systems would do better with the KFC approach, but the fact remains there's a lot of small systems where the advertising funds are used to fund marketing activities, you know, trips to franchise expos and such. And so I think the KFC, I think we've got to be careful about reading too much into the KFC. I think it's a smart practice what KFC did, and I think the judge's ruling recognized that lengthy history.
Mm-hmm. Michael, I know you have some input to share on the KFC case. This is about as good time as any.
Sure. I want to echo Paul's point is, KFC, the association is in charge of the advertising. The franchisor then implements the ad strategy that the KFC Association says to go forward with. The problem which led to this difficulty was not a contractual problem or a problem with interpretation of a contract, although of course that's what you go to the court for. But the franchisor in this case, KFC franchisor, came to the association with some advertising strategies that the KFC association did not agree with, and they were at loggerheads, and their mechanism did not provide for a way of getting around that loggerhead. The franchisor said, well, I've brought you the advertising strategy, and if you don't approve it, I'm not going to bring you any more. That's it. And the association said, well, wait a minute. It's your job. We decide the overall strategy, and you implement it. And we're not implementing. We don't want you to implement this.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, what from a social psychological point of view, what's going on there is they have a very bad dispute resolution mechanism built into their committee structure. And they found out that going to court didn't resolve anything. The judge, in the most polite way, said, you guys are idiots. You'll have to solve this. Get back to work. Now, they've got a very difficult problem, because KFC in North America, anyways, believes that the franchisor is at odds with what the franchisees believe the market to be, and they don't have an effective way of resolving those differences. And what Eric Karp was trying to bring, his message was to all in-house counsel for franchisors, was, look, you've got to resolve these matters with your franchisees, and it's not a matter of contract. It's not a matter of interpretation of trust, the trust indenture. It's a matter of, getting the dispute solved. And if you can't do that, in an ad hoc manner, there are other ways of doing it that don't involve spending a lot of litigation dollars. Both KFC, the association, and the franchisor spent a lot of money and time, effort, only to be told, look, this is a business problem. You people ought to solve it. And most advertising is a business problem that you need people's input to solve. You need their cooperation, you need their coordination, and even if you don't like dealing with them from time to time, you have to. And you are, Eric's overall message was, don't delude yourself, in-house counsel, that if you have a dispute over the ad funds, that even if you win at court, you've achieved anything, because you haven't got the buy-in. And I think that's important for people to understand that, very sophisticated franchise or franchisee side attorneys who have, many, many years of experience in resolving these things are telling you that ad fund disputes seem to be very common, are very common in franchise systems. And no, for the most part, they're not a matter of contractual for trust and indenture interpretation. They're a matter of solving a business dispute.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important point. If you're just joining us today on Franchise Today, I'm joined today by my guests, Michael Webster and Paul Steinberg, franchisee attorneys, as well as with co-producer Joe Caruso. In this week's discussion, we're focusing on the 34th annual meeting of the ABA Forum on franchising, as well as my guests' insight and perspective on the franchise legal landscape. Now, Michael, to your point with respect to the KFC case, is this a unique situation to KFC, or is this something that pretty much is the case across other different franchise systems?
Well, I think what's unique to the KFC case is, of course, their committee structure and how they're going to resolve getting proposals from the franchisor up through the committees and getting it out in time to make the necessary recommendations. What isn't unique, and Eric quite correctly pointed this out, was that ad disputes are endemic to franchising. It doesn't matter what the contract, how the contract's written. It doesn't matter if the contract gives the franchisor, complete and utter discretion over, the content and creation of those ads. You get disputes here, and you get, because there's a lot of money involved, everybody thinks incorrectly that they know how marketing and sales work. And, there is no point in annoying all of your franchisees by adopting a managerial strategy that, reserves all the discretion to the franchisor. And you would know, Paul, that in the smaller franchises, advertising, what you're going to be spending your advertising on is no longer so clear. The national, if you have a regional or smaller brand, it's no longer clear, that spending money, that you can simply go and spend money on television ads, which is a good thing because you probably don't have the money for it anyways. So you have a situation where there's a lot of money at stake. It's unclear how to use it. And you've got a legal document that reserves all of the right to the franchisor to make those discretionary decisions. That is trouble just waiting to happen for every system.
And you do see a lot of, when you see the franchisees that get very angry, it is when, for example, the franchisor uses the money to hire friends and relatives to do marketing, or when the franchisor takes the money to go to one of these, the West Coast Franchise Expo and sell franchises. So, yeah, I think a lot of this is, especially with the smaller systems, it's a perceptual issue.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. And, as we talk about different cases, we probably would be remiss if we didn't discuss the implications of the recent Coverall case in Massachusetts. And having done a bunch of consulting in the commercial cleaning industry and have definitely my own opinions, I'm particularly curious as to what was said at the forum. So if you would, Paul, kind of give us an overview on what was said about the Coverall case and maybe what the tone of the room was with respect to that.
Well, that's interesting.
Do we have enough time for that?
Yeah. well, the thing on Coverall is this: you have a little bit of a split. Franchisee side attorneys seem to be downplaying Coverall. They'll say, look, you know, Coverall was rather, it was a rather unusual franchise system. They collected all the money, which, again, you know, if you've got a Subway or a McDonald's, it's not corporate that's collecting all the money. You know, you collect the money and then send the royalties. Coverall did that upside down. Also, in the case of Coverall, you had very, very sympathetic plaintiffs. You had people that were refugees, immigrants, people that were working long hours for getting less than minimum wage. And I think that the franchisor overplayed their hand. That being said, Coverall was very much a topic at the conference. You've got to realize that while there are some franchisee attorneys, numerically you tend to have more franchisor side attorneys at the ABA forum. And a lot of them were, you did get a little bit of the sky is falling type of thing, mm-hmm. that, oh, this is going to spread to other states, and which, is it going to spread to other states? Yes, on those narrow facts. But okay. Is it going to affect a system like a Dunkin' Donuts? No. And in point of fact, even the Massachusetts legislature, and I talked to a couple of people about this, and the interesting thing is when I would talk to people, and Don Signowski of Blue Mau Mau, he was there. Well, I should mention I attended as a media representative for Blue Mau Mau. Myself and Don Signowski of Blue Mau Mau, when we were talking to people, a lot of these people, the franchisor side attorneys, had not read the judge's decision. A lot of them, most of them, were not at all familiar with what went on in the Massachusetts legislature with regards to Coverall. And when you would talk to them about this, they would say, oh, okay, this isn't such a big issue. You know, yes, if you have employees in disguise, as the Germans call them, if you have employees in disguise, which is what you had with Coverall, yes, the courts are going to whack you because the states need revenue, and if disability insurance isn't being paid, if unemployment insurance isn't being paid, the states get troubled by that, and they are starting to crack down. But I don't really think Coverall is going to spread. I will tell you this. The one thing that you kept hearing from people was that the federal judge just didn't get it. He didn't understand franchising. What really annoyed people was the judge's comment about franchising being a Ponzi scheme. But again, if you read the ruling and if you were at the Massachusetts legislative hearings where they're talking about a bill, they want to propose a bill to overturn Coverall. I don't see that's going to pass. The people in Massachusetts are making a distinction. Coverall is not your typical franchise. And I think that what you had is a lot of the franchisor attorneys are worried, is Coverall, you know, is it the camel's nose under the tent? I personally don't think it's the camel's nose under the tent, but what interested me is that it did seem that a large number, if not a majority, of franchisor side attorneys did seem to think it was the camel's nose under the tent. And that puzzles me. I don't know if Mike Webster has thoughts on that, but that puzzled me.
Well, Mike, this is your cue in to follow up on the camel nose under the tent, which I had never heard before, which I love. So give us your perspective on this.
Well, we don't have a lot of camels in Ontario, but I think Paul is right on two things. One is that if you think that Coverall was just about, you know, franchisees who look like employees, you probably aren't going to find a lot of Coverall cases outside of a few states. And that's just because the Massachusetts test is for who an employee is not widely followed. So I think he's right on that. I think he's also right to point out that the judge saw some, you know, detailed documents about Coveralls franchising practices in which people moved from being franchisees to Coverall employees to back and forth. And having seen those documents, says you can't be in franchising because if you were, you are running a Ponzi scheme, you know, with the implicature being that, and franchising is not a Ponzi scheme. So therefore you can't be in it. However, if I'd like to follow up with Paul's point on, you know, states are in fact starved at this point for revenue. How Coverall offended Massachusetts was not by having employees, you know, or disguised as franchisees, but running a system in which no payroll taxes were paid by anyone. This is similar to what offended Iowa with respect to the KFC case, in which KFC wasn't paying any state income tax. These are both cases which I think that franchisors are going to be concerned with, because they signal, I think, the end of a state just not looking in to the practices of a franchisor and saying, oh yes, these people clearly can't be employers for this payroll tax or for this statutory law. And they're looking for money. The people that have money are going to be the large franchisors. And to the extent that the AG can make a control case to pierce the veil between franchisee and employee, they're going to do so. It may not help the franchisee, but it is going to assist the AGs and those states who are looking for money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Coverall case was discussed by David Marietta in the context of overreaching franchisor control. And this is, I think, is a problem that franchisors will face more scrutiny from the states, not from their own franchisees and franchisee litigation, but they will feel increasing pressure from the states who are looking for their coffers to be filled. And I think that the pendulum is swinging back on some franchisor practices in terms of over control. There's just no necessity for it. And if you're going to annoy states, it's who have the budget to, you know, enforce settlements, onerous settlements, you're better off not to annoy them.
Well, certainly we could talk for hours about the business model of Coverall and other commercial janitorial companies, because it really is a unique business model, and definitely probably lent towards, you know, some of the perception with respect to this. But with that in mind, what does this all mean to similarly situated franchisors in the commercial cleaning industry?
Well, I think they're in trouble. I think there's good reasons, good business reasons for what Coverall did in terms of having a centralized billing. I believe they went too far on it. But you know as well as I do, that's a very difficult business, and there's reasons for the practices that have that are not the practices in commercial cleaning are not replicated in other franchise systems. Mm-hmm. Having said that, they're a natural target right now. They're large. They're in a number of states. They provide an essential service. They're not going anywhere. But you know, although the exact attack on their coffers may not be the Massachusetts one, you know, they put themselves on the radar, haven't they?
Well, definitely put themselves on the radar, and I know Joe and I have had numerous discussions about, you know, like when the Franchise 500 comes out, and, you know, all these commercial cleaning companies are listed as the fastest growing, the largest, et cetera. And of course, you know, that in itself is a discussion for another day because, you know, oftentimes these are investment levels of less than $10,000 and in some cases with certain brands less than $5,000. And to compare them, as a fastest growing franchise or one of the top franchises, comparatively speaking to a bricks and mortar where the total investment is $500,000 or more, you know, certainly is not comparing apples for apples. I know, you know, myself, you know, looking at it from a franchise sales perspective, you know, somebody goes ahead and sells, you know, 90 of these unit level franchises with an investment level of under $10,000 within a 90-day period certainly couldn't be viewed as an effective salesperson comparing it to, you know, somebody that might have sold, you know, $5 million investments over a 90-day period. So, I mean, there definitely needs to be that separation. But, you know, to your point about, you know, not staying under the radar, if anything, they're pushing themselves completely above the radar, right out in the open, by constantly promoting, you know, they're the biggest, the largest, the fastest, et cetera, which, of course, is part of their business model and drawing people in. What does the coverall ruling mean to all franchisors? And this could be either Paul or Michael.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, as I think I indicated, I don't think that franchise attorneys, franchisor attorneys, are taking the correct lesson from this. I had a discussion with one of the people that was very intimately involved in this year's forum, and she said to me when we were discussing this, she was very mad that the judge called franchising a Ponzi scheme. And I said to her, I said, well, leaving that aside, I mean, are you telling your clients to do anything differently? And she just kind of sputtered and said, oh, it's a cautionary tale. Well, yeah, as we discussed, it is a cautionary tale, but I don't think that it's
so
very widely applicable.
Franchising as a Ponzi scheme, a cautionary tale. You can just see the book.
But, I think what she was referring to was, and I think, let me be clear, because this is a serious point. Her point was, insofar as the cautionary tale, was that it related to the degree of control that a franchisor has over the franchisees. Again, for the reasons I discussed, I don't think that that is the proper reading of the case. Franchisors have tremendous control over their franchisees. I owned a Subway, okay? If I was an employee of Doctors Associates, they couldn't see my tax returns. There's a whole host of things that you can do as a franchisor. So I really don't think it was an issue of control. And interestingly, the ABA forum this year also had a session on vicarious liability. Now, one would think that if coverall was this big issue that was opening up the floodgates in terms of potential vicarious liability issues relating to control, that would have been discussed, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I think, to be honest with you, I think that a lot of the issue with coverall is that a lot of franchisors are not willing to simply say, look, these janitorial services are, they're very often disreputable, and that's been true for, what, 20, 30 years now. And rather than separate themselves from this industry segment, franchisors are reaching to embrace it. And I think that's a tactical error. I don't know. Mike, do you agree? Is that...
I think you're right. I didn't understand why the IFA decided that this was something that they should have an amicus brief on. I mean, I understand the politics of it, but I don't think these are the people that you want to stand up and say, yes, these are definitely our guys. I do have to correct Paul a little bit. David's paper, which he referred to, it perhaps wasn't discussed in the session, but David's paper, which for various reasons people don't read these things prior to the conference, there was an extensive discussion in the paper about Coverall. Having said that, I don't think the lesson of Coverall, though, is one of vicarious liability. I think it, if you're, it's one of overreaching control, and in this case, piercing a statutory veil between employee and franchisee. And I think there are a number of ways that that statutory veil could get pierced. And as a franchisor, yes, I would think this is a cautionary lesson. I would look and say, look, are there a bunch of things that I want my franchisees to do? It would be good for everybody if they were compliant to do these things. But no, I can't, you know, require them by contract to do it. Right? Just go through the list of things that you want them to do and then say, look, have I required them by contract to do this? And if you get too many yeses, then you should take Coverall as the caution and say, do I really need to require it, or can we get some, you know, some team play and compliance some other way?
Sure.
And that's the
sure.
caution that you should take out of Coverall.
Hey, Joe, do you have any parting comments on this topic as we move on to a different topic?
Yeah, my perspective on it is that franchisors that think because they're not situated in the janitorial segment that this is a lot of hullabaloo about nothing are really missing the point. There are myriad ways that franchisors can overreach on a unique basis with a particular franchisee and on a systemic basis. And I can't tell you how many times somebody in operations would come to me or somebody in marketing would come to me and say, we got to get all the franchisees on board. We got to make them do this thing. Or they have a unique problem with a particular franchisee, and the operations people aren't getting anywhere with the franchisee, but they're directing their instructions to employees of the franchisee on what they should be doing operationally at on a unit level basis. I think it's very problematic, and it's really easy to fall into that trap. And they really ought to do a little bit of housekeeping and thinking about all the different things that they are trying to mandate. And whether they send out a communique to the whole system say you must do this, or they send direct instructions to employees of a specific franchisee or to that franchisee that you must do this in your market. And I think that these things kind of come to a head, especially when you're dealing with distressed franchisees and telling them how to fix their business. It's really a culture that you have to really worry about and cultivate so that you're careful and you're thoughtful in your directions to franchisees, because you can create vicarious liability, and I think that that's a big issue.
Well, great. Let's move on as we're closing in on the top of the hour, and as everyone on the air knows, I'm very involved in social media. which of course is in a constant state of hyper-evolution. Paul, what was the latest thinking at the conference in terms of legal and practical aspects of social media use within franchise organizations?
Well, this is kind of the dog that didn't bark. You know, a couple of years ago, the ABA Forum was going to do a presentation, and did do a presentation. There was, when people read the course descriptor, there was a little bit of a hullabaloo, and so the actual presentation was avoided the controversial topics. As Mike had said at the outset, the ABA Forum is really moved towards civility, and you know, there's benefits to that, certainly. But as Mike said, I was going to bring up the downside. I think this is one of the downsides. The issue of what is going on with social media is a little bit of a hot button one in the employee-employer relationship. You know, the American Medical case and some of the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, rulings recently. It is a tough one because you've got to balance free speech against the interests of an employer or a franchisor. You also have the practical issue of when people do postings, how do you even determine who they are? I mean, you know, with the technology, daisy chains and Tor and things like that, there's technical ways that make it very difficult to track who people are. So I don't think that the franchise bar has quite figured out how to deal with social media. And in particular, certainly you can put things in your offering circular that say, well, you know, we've got to have the rights to your website or things like that. But I don't think that anybody has figured out how to deal with this on a practical basis. And I know Mike Webster is, you know, he's dealt on a lot more of this than I do. I don't know. Maybe he has some thoughts.
Yeah, Mike, why don't you give us a little input as we're closing in quickly at the top of the hour.
I'll just say one thing about this. This, again, is an area. Social media is the result of the last 8 or 9 years of the traditional national advertising method collapsing. You can't just put money now into a television ad and say more money, more sales. There, you know, that bundle has fallen apart. And social media is one of the things that have, you know, jumped out of that bundle. And franchisors and franchisees are equally, as with all of us, are equally unclear as how to proceed. And I think that a franchisor who writes a franchise contract that says reserves all the discretion in this area to themselves is not well advised. The forum itself, their main nod to technological innovation was to make the papers available on an application for a BlackBerry or iPhone to download. However, they still own the entire copyright on the paper, so nobody can discuss the papers afterhand.
or at another show, because we are running quickly out of time. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Paul, for being our guest today on Franchise Day. We look forward to having you back on a future show, because I mean there's a lot to talk about with respect to all these things, as well as other things coming down the pike. So thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Joe, another great show. Learned about the camel's nose under the tent and dogs that didn't bark, and it was an enlightening show, all kidding aside. Thanks for coordinating it, and as always, thanks for a great topic and your involvement in Franchise Today.
Well, my pleasure. It's always nice to get three New Yorkers to beat up on one Canadian.
There you go. Until next week, when we have Shelley Sun on, and we'll be talking about her book, Grow Smart, Risk Less. I'm Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.
There we go.